This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars Episode 44 was recorded on August 12th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Jeffrey Snyder, CIO from Alhambra Investments, is back with us this week. Jeff prepared a fantastic slide deck that you're really going to want to download because the entire interview is going to center on the discussion of the slides that that deck contains. You'll find the download link on our homepage at macrovoices.com in the description of this article. Jeff, we've had a whirlwind week in markets with the Fed rate cut followed by President Trump's announcement of new China tariffs. China's currency crossing 7 RMB or CNY or yuan, which are all almost the same thing for the benefit of our listeners, to the dollar. So that caused everyone, I think, to think, wow, yuan crossing 7 to the US dollar. That's kind of the Rubicon for that currency. Many observers think that this is an intentional move on China's part, retaliation, if you will, for the tariffs, and to provide stimulus for China's exporters. And even the U.S. Treasury labeled China a currency manipulator based on this reasoning. Do you see this move as intentional retaliation for the tariffs?
Well, Eric, that's what all the textbooks say. Whenever you see the currency moving in that direction, immediately people begin to suspect that there has to be someone behind it, especially if or when that specific country's economy is experiencing problems itself. The two do seem to go together, you know, economic weakness and the tendency of the exchange value to move lower. And we're all taught from the very beginning that it's part of the official toolkit, you know, maybe closer to a break the glass in case of emergency part of the toolkit. But when the going gets tough, you beggar thy neighbor. You lower the currency translation to make your goods cheaper to buy on global markets. And like magic, the export sector roars to life and pulls you out of the mess. And if it becomes less costly to buy your goods as opposed to your neighbors, then so be it. You know, that's the theory anyway. And absent any other explanation, that's what everyone says it has to be.
Well, Jeff, knowing you pretty well after a few years, I'm pretty sure that you don't believe the mainstream consensus on this one.
Yeah, of course not. So let's start on slide 3. We're often given these kinds of shorthand explanations and never really given them much thought because they sound plausible enough. You know, weaker currency means it takes less of someone else's currency to buy the same amount of goods. So why wouldn't that work? And ceteris paribus, it just might. If the Chinese are relying on the textbook and expecting a weaker CNY to boost their exports, then they just haven't been paying attention to either the currency or their exports. It's not as if the Chinese currency just dropped yesterday. It began falling all the way back in April of 2018. So there's obviously more going on here, and it relates to the dollar. And on slide 4, what we see that, you know, what's finally being acknowledged is a global financial channel. When CNY fell, it went down by a pretty substantial amount, much more than now last year. Despite what was supposed to have been currency and export stimulus, Chinese exports have ground to a halt, and they've done the opposite of what the theory behind the currency war teaches. Even though the Chinese goods are now much cheaper to buy, especially for anyone using U.S. dollars to buy them, which is practically everyone, and that's the real problem.
Okay, we covered China, but what about elsewhere?
Well, Europe is another perfect contrary example. On slide 5, you see how the euro began to fall against the dollar at the very same time CNY did, which raises a question about the establishment narrative. After all, what are the chances that two independent economic blocs decide to, quote unquote, devalue at the very same time? You know, Europe's currency has been grinding lower for a year and a half, and yet no one is calling the Europeans currency manipulators. And even if they did, it's another case of failed effort. You know, despite a much weaker currency, the European economy has gone further in the wrong direction. In places like Germany, where exports are a key driving factor for its industrial sector, you know, what we see, go to slide 6, as the euro falls, you know, a deeper and deeper manufacturing recession has developed in Germany. So the euro is down significantly, and so are German factories. The two actually go together. So, you know, it's not intentional devaluation as a policy. It is incidental devaluation as a global financial matter. When the dollar rises, because that's what's on the other side of all of these things, bad things tend to happen for the global economy. And it isn't that for one country or another, and it's not that which forces their own currency lower. You know, they're not doing it themselves. It is that the dollar is squeezed higher, which results in what looks like it must be intentional devaluation because nobody talks about the dollar side of it. And they should, because this isn't the first time we've seen this, especially in China.
Before anyone was even talking about tariffs or trade wars, I seem to recall how we saw a similar devaluation back in August of 2015. It seemed like it came out of nowhere and certainly grabbed everyone's attention. What was driving that devaluation back in 2015, and are the same factors in play now in this current event?
Yeah, they are. It's not perfectly identical, but mostly the same factors, starting with the dollar being forced higher. You know, conventionally, people talk about capital flows and hot money, and those are along the right track, and at least the right frame of mind. And just to clarify up front, you know, I'm going to be leaving a few things out of the presentation here for the sake of time and simplifying a lot of these things.
And listeners, please check the description of today's interview on our homepage at macrovoices.com, where you'll find some links to articles that Jeff has written, which will dive deeper into the details that we don't have time to cover today. Anyone who wants to can follow Jeff further down this rabbit hole, and these are some really important concepts on how the monetary system actually works beyond the shorthand cliches.
Yeah, Eric, I think you pointed out on our last podcast together how it seems like when I answer one question, it only raises three or four others. You know, and that's really how it is. Everything is interconnected and interrelated. So when you're talking about something like the Chinese currency, which seems like it should be straightforward, we're really talking about four or five different core concepts, which maybe at first don't seem like they should be all in the same place, or it isn't intuitive how they might all fit together.
Well, Jeff, when other guests that we have on Macro Voices answer one question, it leads to several others. When you answer one question, it leads to an outright Twitter rebellion where we get overwhelmed with thousands of additional questions. And we're going to try to touch on as many of these as we possibly can in coming weeks. But for our purposes today, let's get back to CNY and 2015.
Okay, well, let's start with a very simple model. Slide 7 here. Everyone around the world needs dollars. That's what a global reserve currency is. It is a necessary requirement for global trade and global financial flows. It's the very language and resource of global trade. So China needs dollars. It needs a lot of dollars each and every day. And the Chinese, like everyone else, have to obtain these dollars on a regular basis. And they get them from global banks, which participate in this offshore Eurodollar market. And the way the Chinese do it is by borrowing dollars from these banks in the short run and in many different types of formats.
Jeff, wasn't that the whole point of foreign reserves, though? I mean, the Chinese amassed the largest stockpile of foreign reserves on the entire planet, up to $4 trillion at one point, if I recall correctly. The reason that they were doing it was so that they would be protected against the kind of situation where dollar funding would be an issue.
Yeah, exactly, Eric. And that was another convention which had developed out of the Asian crisis or the Asian flu of 1998, which is maybe the first systemic Eurodollar problem, by the way. The lesson everyone was told to take from that event was how countries had better build up a stockpile of foreign reserves just in case, for whatever reason or reasons, you couldn't find dollars so easily, like Thailand and the Asian tigers 20 years ago found themselves with. And that's what everyone did, China most of all. The problem is that nobody bothers to think about the other side of the ledger. With all of these virtual dollars flowing into China, most of them would end up in the government's hands and on the central bank's balance sheet. On slide 8, we see, you know, that was on the one hand the country's reserve stockpile, but they didn't just sit there like some insurance company's portfolio. That reserve stockpile was also the basis for the internal money supply. Go to slide 9. When you look at the balance sheet of the People's Bank of China, what you find on the asset side is that it is primarily made up of these foreign reserves. China's monetary system is, in effect, dollarized. And again, I'm simplifying that, you know, not all of these assets are dollar denominated. This is where the Chinese buy all our treasuries, by the way. They aren't sitting in a lockbox in Beijing. They're sitting at the base of China's renminbi on the asset side of the PBOC's balance sheet.
Okay, Jeff, so if I've got this right, these U.S. treasuries that everyone's always talking about, all of those excess treasuries that China could sell at any minute if they wanted to, they're really kind of encumbered from what you're saying. I mean, they're spoken for in the sense of being at the base of China's money system, and that means that if they're serving that purpose, they can't just be arbitrarily sold. Is that correct?
Yeah, what everybody thinks is a reserve stockpile, the sort of dollar insurance, is really a pretty powerful dilemma. If suddenly dollars are hard to come by for China, they're supposed to be able to just sell their U.S. treasuries and fill the gap, like you were saying. But if they sell those treasuries, and we go to slide 10 here, they are actually cutting into the RMB money supply inside their own borders. You know, $1 less in U.S. treasuries available is $1 less on the PBOC's asset side of its balance sheet, which has to be balanced out by $1 less in liabilities, meaning either currency or bank reserves. So it becomes a choice. And outside of our simple model, it is a very complex and multidimensional one. You know, the Chinese have to ask themselves, do I sell the treasuries to offset this dollar problem and accept the internal monetary contraction? Or do I try to avoid selling treasuries and find some other way of solving this problem? You know, because you can't just ignore the dollar problem. You have to do something. But at what cost? You know, and there's always trade-offs, even for central banks. And in this case, the simple trade-off is U.S. Treasury selling that you see on slide 11 for internal RMB contraction, which we'll get to in a moment. An external dollar problem is dealt with by an internal monetary contraction.
Jeff, I can see here from your slides that the Chinese did draw down an enormous amount of their foreign reserves back in 2014 and into 2015. At the same time, like you said, it caused a pretty substantial decline in the Chinese RMB bank reserves.
Yeah, beginning on slide 12, the drawdown in PBOC assets comes from the foreign asset side of its balance sheet. When there are fewer of these coming into China, and when the PBOC starts to use them, that reduces first the growth rate of the balance sheet, the overall balance sheet, and at times it can even lead to contraction in it, a very real quantitative tightening, except it's not purposeful policy, it's just monetary tightening. Fewer assets mean fewer liabilities, which in the case of central bank accounting means these forms of money shown on slide 13. Bank reserves contract as well as a big slowdown in the rate of currency expansion. And I'm talking about physical RMB currency issue. The growth in the currency grinds to a halt, or nearly a halt, because the asset side of the PBOC's balance sheet was shrinking when China decided it had to come to grips with its dollar problem and how it decided to come to grips with its dollar problem.
Well, Jeff, that's a pretty big dilemma. In order to face up to the dollar problem, you have to effectively run the money printing press in reverse, contracting rather than expanding the money supply. You never hear about central banks voluntarily choosing to contract their money supply. They always want to print more, don't they?
Yeah, and again, there are consequences and there are trade-offs to all these kinds of methods. China's economy slowed dramatically as a result of all of this. You know, people who had been thinking in 2014 China was going to, you know, the Chinese economy was going to take off again and lead the world back to a pre-crisis level of growth. Suddenly in 2015, they were saying hard landing. And that's what monetary contraction will do. And this is another one of those complications we aren't going to spend a lot of time on here. You know, the PBOC tried to offset the sharp decline in bank reserves by unlocking more of what Chinese banks had been required to hold in reserve, you know, the so-called RRR or required reserve ratio. You know, briefly, by reducing the RRR, the PBOC was hoping that banks would be able to use more of the reserves they were already holding, and that would offset what was a pretty severe and involuntary form of central bank money tightening. Now, the RRRs can't really be stimulus because they begin with RMB money already deep in a hole. And so, as I said, you know, it's a convoluted and uncertain answer to a multidimensional problem. The RRRs, like, you know, currency devaluation, they're talked about as stimulus, when in fact they're a very poor substitute for regular money side growth.
So there's every reason to be reluctant to just use those foreign reserves. Jeff, I get how Chinese officials must be a little uneasy selling off their U.S. treasuries, contracting their money supply, and then just trusting or maybe hoping that Chinese banks will come to their rescue. That's a lot of moving pieces and a lot of ways that things could go wrong. And things did go wrong, if I remember correctly, as 2015 wasn't a very good year in China or for the rest of the world, for that matter.
Yeah, right. And as the skies darkened over there early on in 2015, and after having sold a ton of U.S. treasuries off their asset side, the PBOC began to look toward other options. And China wasn't the only country facing this dollar problem, obviously. It was a systemic issue. Other countries had been confronting what were largely the same set of constraints, you know, this external dollar problem becoming an internal money one. Brazil, for example, if we go to slide 14, right off the bat in 2013, the Brazilians decided there was no way they were going to use their reserves, unlike China. They were going to face the dollar difficulties almost surreptitiously using what one central bank paper euphemistically described as contingent liabilities. Now, that's a loaded term, and it means different things in different contexts. But the idea is very simple, and it's simple enough. You know, how do you deal with a dollar problem without disturbing your reserves and therefore your internal money supply? The government can go into the marketplace, source these quote-unquote contingent liabilities, and then influence the dollar dynamic, including the currency exchange value. And it doesn't have to be the government. It could be the central bank or even a local domestic bank or two acting on behalf of either of those.
Hold on a minute, Jeff. It sounds like what you're saying is that government officials, in order to avoid all those complications we just talked about, are basically sneaking off into the shadows. And what, they're building up some sort of off-the-books war chest or something?
Yeah, it's a fuzzy derivatives war chest of dollars. Look, they're already operating in the shadows anyway. So in lieu of selling U.S. treasuries outright, you then use these swaps and other derivatives, you know, these contingent liabilities, use them as the basis to try to influence dollar conditions along the way, either directly or you know, through providing resources like foreign currency coverage to domestic banks. You're essentially subsidizing the banking sector's dollar problems with the hope that, you know, it becomes less of a problem with time. You parcel out this war chest piecemeal each and every day the dollar issue remains, you know, hoping that it doesn't run out. So let's say it's the central bank who accumulates this war chest via swaps. A swap means you obtain dollar liabilities today and promise to pay them back in the future. The terms are typically 3 months long. The first batch will come due then, meaning that you have to repay them in 3 months. And you can limit yourself to one go of it or, you know, 1 3-month term, or you can build a bigger war chest by staggering out maturities at 3-month intervals. And the idea here is again, really just trying to buy time. You know, I know I'm leaving out a lot of specifics at this point, but by subsidizing the dollar problem, the central bank just hopes it goes away. You think, well, I'll cover my banks for 3 months, and by then, whatever this dollar problem is, it will be done by the time these things start to mature. So by doing this, it allows you to, among other things, stabilize the currency. In Chinese case, if you go to slide 15, CNY would trade sideways or even appreciate, because like the Brazilian said, this can be an effective technique in the short run.
In the short run. Okay, but I take it from that statement that there are trade-offs using this scheme. So is there something beyond just the short run?
If you're trying to buy time, what happens in 3 months if the dollar problem is still a problem? You've got a whole bunch of swaps or, you know, whatever, the first batch of whatever contingent liabilities that are coming due, and you have to pay them back or roll them over at an even greater cost. And you used up some, maybe even a lot of your war chest over those 3 months. So in other words, you know, every 3 months that this dollar problem continues, it becomes a decision point. The PBOC, because we're using the Chinese example, the PBOC has to decide if it can keep up subsidizing local banks and their dollar issues and at what level. That's why what you see in CNY during the 2015-16 period is a 3-month repeating interval, or what I call a ticking clock. When a batch of contingent liabilities, these central bank swaps, start to come due, the PBOC has to readjust or let the market readjust the currency to a more manageable level. In the case of an ongoing dollar problem, that means CNY falls. So the biggest of those breaks came during August of 2015. You know, global dollar stress had built up, plus there were considerations about the state and the cost of the war chest that led the PBOC to just throw up their hands and say, you know, they had to let the market go much lower on CNY, or else they were going to be intervening far too much, far too fast. Not only would the war chest be emptied if it hadn't been already, the PBOC would have to sell an enormous amount of treasuries on top of what had already been sold just to hold the currency steady, or even just to limit the drop to a small one.
Those things would just make it worse. From what I know, the PBOC letting the currency fall and maybe selling more reserves just makes people even more nervous and more uncertain. In the dollar world that you're talking about, it seems to me like it would just make it worse. The euro-dollar market would see these kinds of frantic actions and then want to offer and supply even fewer dollars to China than it already has been.
Yeah, that's the real danger when it becomes a self-reinforcing spiral, almost like a dollar run. You know, the whole point of contingent liabilities in this context, you know, these dollar swaps and this war chest, is to stabilize the currency by convincing the market that nothing's wrong. There are no risks. It's an artificial calm, if you will, that you hope says to the euro dollar market, hey, bring all your dollars back because everything is fine. You know, especially if you can get CNY moving higher at some point in these ticking clock cycles, that's the message you hope to send.
And if the euro-dollar market doesn't buy it, then 3 months later, the CNY has to be adjusted. Because let's face it, sometimes if a move is artificial, you can tell it's artificial.
Yeah, that's what happened throughout the latter half of 2015 and throughout much of 2016. Until later on in 2016, when the PBOC just threw in the towel and started selling off treasuries again. But by then, they had chosen to offset those sales with other asset side programs, you know, which is another complication we're not going to get into here. In slide 16, in addition to the RMB programs, there was another layer of dollar bypassing, which was instituted at the time, which seems to have drawn in Hong Kong. And as much as I want to talk about Hong Kong with everything going on there now, there's just no way we can get into it today. I mean, these are very complicated methods and different ways that the central banks can try to handle what is a very big and tough problem.
And listeners, bear with us. We'll try to get to Hong Kong in a separate episode when we can, but we had to decide for today. There was just no way to include it in the amount of time that we have. So, Jeff, if I get what you're saying, China is once again experiencing a dollar problem that it has chosen to confront with contingent liabilities rather than the outright selling of U.S. treasuries. And I presume the reason that they're not outright selling the U.S. treasuries is because they need them for the structural reasons that we talked about earlier in terms of backing their own currency system.
Yeah, and Eric, it doesn't have to be an either-or situation. The Chinese can do both, and they often do both. It's really about striking some kind of balance, looking at the circumstances from all of these different angles, because there are trade-offs in every direction. So there's going to be some selling of treasuries and accepting some monetary contraction, but you don't want it to be too much. So you also do some of these swaps and contingent liabilities and building the off-the-books war chest, as you put it. You know, how much emphasis you place on which one is different every time. So the same process repeats, but it's a slightly different look each time it does repeat.
Okay, so in other words, we still had a dollar problem that started last year. And I know that you've mentioned April and May quite a lot. So the CNY fell sharply, but then the contingent liabilities show up in order to balance out any need to sell too many treasuries. So it's almost like they wanted to sell more treasuries, but they couldn't get away with selling more treasuries. So they effectively sold those treasuries by instead increasing these contingent liabilities. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, if you go to slide 17, right at the end of October 2018, that's what we're really talking about. Just as everything really starts to go haywire around the world, you know, a real amplification of the global dollar problem, all of a sudden, CNY turns around and heads higher. It was a complete breaking of the correlation where bad things usually correlate to when CNY falls. So the PBOC comes in at the end of October using these swaps or contingent liabilities, and whatever kind, and we have no specific idea what they are since they're never reported, you know. And so that sets in motion the first ticking clock. 3 months forward from the end of October is the end of January. They are either expecting the dollar problem would be over by then, or if it's not, CNY has to be adjusted with the first batch of those liabilities expiring.
And that's just what happened. The yuan had begun rising, as you said, and then right at the end of January, exactly 3 months later, it's no longer rising.
Yeah, so it's still a dollar problem. So another 3 months later, you get to the end of April, and CNY is adjusted downward rather sharply, almost like the war chest is being depleted, and the Chinese are hanging on to CNY by a smaller and smaller thread. And then 3 months later from that, end of July, which we just went through, you know, a couple weeks ago, currency has to be adjusted lower yet again.
Okay, so does that mean that President Trump is right and the Chinese are manipulating their currency?
Yeah, well, they are manipulating their currency. It's just not at all in the way that everybody's talking about. You know, they're desperately trying to stabilize a currency that just won't be stable because of a global dollar shortage that is just getting worse, which, as you know, Eric, you know, that's been the subject of our past few discussions. This also explains why devaluation doesn't work as stimulus. One, it isn't devaluation, but a rising dollar. And two, a rising dollar means financial trouble through this global financial channel, which can only lead to deepening economic trouble. So you've got the media and even politicians talking about currency stimulus and devaluation and textbook devaluation. You know, even the RR cuts, they're declared as stimulus. And, you know, they never once factor how any of these other dollar angles are involved, especially the internal effects of a rising dollar. You know, we live in an age of econometrics where economists have developed these very elegant and complex statistical models that never perform well or never perform up to task, because they're based on these conventions and shorthands that are either outdated or just invalid. So I've come up with my own very simple formula everyone can use instead to a much better effect. On slide 18, you know, a lower CNY is bad. It's not bad because China's currency is being devalued, but because it signals that there's a whole lot of things that are going on behind it, that the financial channel of the euro dollar is destructively being disturbed.
And that disturbance is important not just to China, but to the entire planet. And again, listeners, for a deeper look at all of these issues, including quite a few we didn't have time to get into, please refer to the links that we've included in the description of today's podcast on our homepage at macrovoices.com. We're going to bring you a whole bunch of more content on these subjects and many more in coming weeks and months. And listeners, stay tuned to your Macro Voices channel this week. We've got quite a bit of exciting content. Professor Steve Keen is going to be back with us on All Stars this week. Louis Vincent Gav is going to be with us. We've also got Energy Week this week featuring Dr. Anna Salhaji, Joe McMonagle from HedgEye, Tracy Shuchart, and we have Professor Daniel Lacaille returning as this week's feature interview guest on the flagship Macro Voices podcast on Thursday evening. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.